Welcome to episode 2 of The Wedding DJ, a story of love and music in the 1980s. Sally was in her bedroom with her girlfriends, Linda and Donna. They heard the sound of the doorbell ringing from the other room.
Why do you think Jen's so late again?
Bet you it's the same excuse as last time. Overtime at work. Except for the fact that they don't give anyone overtime at that place.
Linda, Donna, you two be nice. Jen's been going through a lot lately, especially with Kevin, so show some empathy.
Mom?
Can I get you girls anything? I have your missing cohort here.
Oh, we're good, Mom. Thanks. Thanks for letting Jen in.
All right, but if you change your mind, just let me know.
Roberta turned around and left the bedroom, while Jen took a seat on the bed close to Sally.
So nice you could join us.
Apologies. The manager asked if I could stay a bit longer.
Donna and Linda glanced back at each other in disbelief. They had heard this one before.
Okay, where were we before we got so distracted?
The same place where we've always been. Boys. Do I dare say boys?
Don't you mean why can't they act more like men? Real men.
Yeah.
Commiserating about their respective boyfriends' immaturity often prevailed as the hot topic of discussion, but without much resolve. All four girls shared the same desire to be married. However, the challenge was getting their significant other to pop the big question. Coming up with solutions remained problematic.
Jason has seemed so distant lately. Like, when we go out to spend time together, it's like he isn't there. His mind wanders off to some other place.
Kevin gets really quiet at times, too. Almost to the point that it's like, I'm not there. I feel so ignored.
Obviously, something is going on in that head of his.
Mm-hmm.
I know he can speak. I know he's a highly intelligent person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is it about men in general that they find it so difficult to share, to communicate, to talk like rational human beings?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I get it.
Though she related that thought to men, she was directing the concept at Jason. Sally had other male friends, but there was and had been no other guys in her romantic life other than Jason. He was the one and only, her one and only true love. Sally's comment caused Linda and Donna, who were seated on the bedroom floor, to start giggling.
What are you laughing about?
You and your boyfriends, Jen. It's just so cute.
Maybe if you had a boyfriend for any length of time, you would understand better. But you've been one date Donna for so long, you have no idea what it's like to be in a relationship for more than a month at a time.
Wow.
Though voiced in a lighthearted tone, she made her point and Donna was speechless and astonished. In all the years the girls had known each other, Jen had never said a mean or derogatory word to anyone. With that remark, Jen took a pillow from the bed and threw it at Donna. In return, Donna responded by taking the pillow and throwing it back. For a moment, a mini pillow fight broke out in Sally's bedroom, just like when they were young girls. Back in those more youthful days, sleepovers had always taken place in Sally's bedroom, and pillow fights became a common occurrence on many of those nights. The girls, much younger at the time, would jump on the bed, tossing and throwing the pillows at each other, laughing and giggling all the while. The pillow fight would usually end after they all fell on the bed. This time, the pillow fight ended when one of the nightstand lamps fell crashing to the floor. The sound of the nightstand lamp hitting the ground caused the girls to freeze. Luckily, there was not much damage, at least nothing too serious. However, the mood in the room had gone from a frenzy to a state of plasticity. At 25, Sally still lived at home with her parents, even though she could adequately get along independently. Her teacher's salary made it more than possible to afford rent at a beautiful, comfortable apartment or small house, but she felt the calling to stay close to her parents. More than 20 years had elapsed since Sally's sister, April, passed away from leukemia just a week before what would have been her 6th birthday. Though believers in God and Jesus, and knowing that one day they would be reunited with their daughter in heaven, still it wasn't enough. Consequently, fear ruled her parents' inability to let go of the past. Early on, Sally adopted the philosophy that God spoke to her about the situation. She understood what her parents needed, which meant living inside the same four walls of the house, all three of them together. Time might have healed the wounds, but the memories remained. Grief resolution seemed like an overwhelming and daunting task, trying to be both realistic and optimistic. They were striving to survive it, even while being changed by it. The loss of April, watching her breathe her first breaths, the expectation of participating in future memories all vanished with her passing. Over the years, the sadness and tears had diminished, but every once in a while, Sally's mom, Roberta, would go to her bedroom with the shades drawn closed, lie on the bed in the fetal position, and cry until there were just no more tears to be shed. Roberta, who tended to be shy and sensitive, had taken the loss incredibly hard. She blamed herself for April's illness because when she was pregnant, she began gaining weight. Her doctor put her on a prescription of diet pills during the pregnancy. Though this practice was common in those days, and even though there was no conclusive proof that the prescription medication caused leukemia, Roberta felt it was her fault. She took the blame and responsibility for her daughter's death and was filled with gut-wrenching sorrow and pain. Only after years of therapy did Roberta begin to let go of the notion that her action was not the cause of cancer. Samuel, Sally's father, took a different direction. He got enraged. He was furious at the doctors, the hospitals, but most of all, he just blamed God. Filled with intense anger and emotions of bitterness and unfairness, he deemed his life left unfulfilled. In his view, someone had to be responsible for April's death. Someone had to be accountable. He did not share Roberta's self-appointed judgment of herself. He loved his wife far too much for her to take the blame. Instead, Samuel stayed away from the church, harbored away for many years, trying to make sense out of something fundamentally irrational or illogical in his mind. He anguished over the lost opportunities that would have come from raising April, watching her grow from the little child that she was into a teenager and then an adult. He lamented that there would be no father-daughter dance at school. He would never walk her down the aisle to be married, things he had so looked forward to as a father. Years later, with his heart beginning to soften, Roberta convinced him to come back to church with her and Sally. Many of the congregants were surprised to see Samuel again in the church pews, knowing he kept so much anger inside. And on that Sunday, the beginning of a change of heart emerged as the pastor voiced a message that seemed to be directed right at Samuel.
In this world, you will have tribulation. There will be trials and times of pain that you question and ask, "Why me?" You will be tested. You must give yourself permission to express your anger in appropriate ways, rather than internalizing the pain and sadness. And take to heart, because you have a Savior that overcame the world.
It stuck with Samuel and helped him better understand his journey in this life. Just as the years of therapy had helped Roberta deal with her grief and loss. Through it all, even during the most profound, darkest moments, neither Roberta nor Samuel lost their faith, at least not all of it. And inasmuch of their ability to persevere, subsequently being tested time and time again, that profound faith permeated and rooted deep in the heart and soul of their daughter Sally. In turn, Sally became the glue that held the family tightly together. But that glue came with a cost. Unlike any other girl in Kokomo, The ability to grow up normal was not to be Sally's fate. Alternatively, her parents took extreme measures. There wasn't much Roberta and Samuel wouldn't do to protect their daughter from any possibility of endangerment, imperilment, vulnerability, and precariousness, anything standing in harm's way. Consequently, when it came time to begin school, her mom walked her to school early in the morning and came back in the mid-afternoon to walk her back home. She was never allowed to go on any school outings, no sleepovers at a friend's house, and even things like riding a bicycle were only allowed under the guidance of at least one parent. Supervision was an essential element for Samuel and Roberta. As Sally grew into her teen years, tensions eased in the home. And while there might have been some other kids, friends of Sally's, with parents whose micromanaging deprived their children of free will and prevented them from becoming proactive adults, it was not the outcome for Sally. She spent her time studying for school, reading books, always doing something. Whether it was making home-baked cookies and learning to sew a dress, she was consistently motivated. But above all, she loved her parents and told them so every day.
Sally, are you with us?
I think she's in La La Land.
No. No, I'm here. I was just thinking about my sister.
You've never really talked much about her before?
Well, that's because I never really got to know her. I never had the chance. I never knew what happened until I was old enough to research her disease.
Sally, didn't your mom or dad say something?
I tried asking my mom because I wanted to know. I was curious. I honestly wanted to know more, but bringing up the subject just rekindled this deep sadness inside her. And then my mom gets really quiet. It's always so complicated for her to talk about it, even if she's able to at all.
That's so sad.
Yeah.
Sally instinctively understood the difficulty her mom was going through, understood her challenges, and did not press her for any information. Instead, she would hold her mom, wrap her arms around her, and give her great big bear hugs. Sometimes during those hugs, Sally would feel a teardrop fall from her mother's face. It was then, while Sally was hugging her mom, that she would say a short silent prayer to God, asking him to ease the pain, take away the sorrow, and restore her mom to the loving lady she always was and always would be. Jen, who had been Sally's best friend since fourth grade, was well aware of the challenges facing a family with the loss of a child. In many ways, and over many years of friendship, Jen had become Sally's surrogate sister. But astonishingly, they were two entirely different people. They had similar goals of being married and having a family, but they viewed the world quite differently beyond that. Sally went on to college. Jen never finished community college, dropping out after 6 months. Sally was a well-spoken deep thinker, exceptionally good at being by herself. Jen, in comparison, was boisterous and gregarious, enjoying the girls' company and conversation, and loved to be the center of attention as much as possible. Jen's family had survived tragedy and had become stronger because of it. Jen's parents divorced many years ago. Her father got to a point where his drinking was uncontrolled and problematic. Though he was well-educated and had a higher-than-average income, he would binge drink every other day. Her mother couldn't take the unpredictable behavior. Divorce was inevitable. Jen claimed she heard stories that her grandfather had been the same way, though she never knew him. With both families, there was tremendous loss. Sally and Jen shared that common bond, and they held to it tightly. Sally understood who Jen was, but also knew better not to pass judgment on her. With over 20 years of friendship behind them, they got on famously.
Come on, girls. Can we get back on track?
Oh, you mean the proverbial road to marriage? My endless pursuit of finding the perfect guy to give me the perfect life.
And who's been the newest flavor of the month, Donna?
Hey, you don't need to get callous about it. I'm a picky girl and I want a certain type of man.
Well, Sally and I have been dating our guys for years. Where's that got us?
I believe we have good men in our lives, They are slowly finding their way. You know, we just need to be patient for that blessed day to come. I put my trust in the higher authority.
At least Jason keeps his hands and eyes to himself. But Kevin, I've seen his head turn one too many times when there's another woman around. Jen, that has to drive you crazy.
It irritates me to no end. But when it happens, I give him a little whack on the back of his head. He looks back at me, quickly apologizes, and gives me one of those gorgeous smiles. Mm.
That must be a lot of little whacks.
Yeah. Oh, but that smile.
Looks and appearances were more important to Jen than the internal content, the character of the person. Some would say Jen was shallow, didn't care, or didn't want to be involved with serious and important things, but that assessment of her would not be totally accurate.
I'm going to speak up in Jen's defense. I've been going steady with Jason for 7 years, and Jen's been going out with Kevin for 5 years. Our respective relationships have been defined by staying with our significant others for an extended amount of time under the assumption that they would refrain from dating other people during that time. Given that that amount of time has been substantial, marriage is the logical next step.
Yes. Yeah. I think I know where this is going.
Mm-hmm. Look, there are other considerations, too. Future expectations girls have. Not only do we hope for that day when our men finally get the courage to pop the question, but there's also the issue of fertility. You know, that inherent timing mechanism. After all, girls, I mean, we're not getting any younger, and our biological clocks are near the peak of our reproductive years, if you know what I mean. Put yourself in my shoes. Here I am, dating the same man for nearly 8 years, hoping and waiting and praying for that day when he asks me to marry him. He knows I love him dearly, want to have his children, and most certainly want to spend the rest of my life with him. That said, this world just gets a little crazier, more contentious, and more dubious each and every day. And still, the clock keeps on ticking. You know, my clock is ticking, too.
Jen looked over at Sally with that look of deep-rooted friendship that happens throughout a lifetime.
Everything will work out. Jason is a good guy. He's going to make the right decision. He's going to do the right thing.
Those were the words of comfort Sally had been hearing from Jen for many years. But now, those words provided less of that comforting feeling than they used to. Sometimes Sally carried the weight of the world on her shoulders. She was the glue to her mom and dad. She was the rock to Jason. Where and when would she finally receive her due, all she had been waiting for? Truth be told, Sally had wanted Jason to pop the question for quite some time, and under no uncertain terms would she bring up the subject herself. It was not the way her system of values worked. Under Midwest values, an honest day's work deserves a fair day's pay. Hard work, modesty, your work is your bond, always lend a helping hand, your name and reputation are your most prized possession. There's an unwaveringly pragmatic and dogmatic belief that hard work and perseverance rooted in quiet humility pays off in the long run. And though Sally believed in those core values, this was a testing moment. She wondered if she would ever make it to the altar with Jason. Being the very old-fashioned girl she was, it would be the man's place to do this if ever it was to happen. It was the man's place to ask.
So, Jen, what are your plans with Kevin? You want to be married to him, don't you?
Yeah, I guess I could marry Kevin, but I have no timetable. I'm not even sure I want kids.
Kids! I want to have 3. 2 girls and a boy.
I'd love a half dozen.
Wow, that's a lot.
Donna thought that Sally was getting a little too earnest. Though she had not known Sally as long as Jen, the two had shared a considerable number of memories. And even though Donna came off as a wild and crazy soul at times, when push came to shove, when the pressure was on, the situation was critical and urgent. When the time called for action, no matter how hard or stressful, they all wanted the right guy. They wanted the same thing as Sally, They talked through a list of some of those qualities they wanted from the man they would marry. Loyal, romantic, and thoughtful were at the top of the list. But they also agreed that it was important to have someone who makes you feel relaxed and comfortable to be with, whether you were laughing or crying in front of him. Having someone who made you happy and treated you like a princess. Someone who was a good listener and paid attention no matter what you said. Someone who was sweet, with a kind and loving heart. And the girls were in full agreement that it would not hurt if he looked good too. Sally was getting a little worked up over this. The thought of marriage and kids had been on her mind for quite some time. She was contemplating the worst case scenario. What if Jason never came through, never asked her to marry him? Sally would instead ponder the possibility of the storybook ending she had held on to for so long. But what if that was not meant to be? Jen came close to Sally, took hold of her hands, looked her squarely in the eye.
Sally, Jason's a good guy, and he's gonna come around one day. He's going to make you the happiest girl on the face of this planet. Everything's going to work out.
Sally's eyes began to well up. Most of the time, her emotions were usually in check. But this moment turned into too many thoughts of unfulfilled expectations. As much as she wanted to trust and believe that everything would work out in the end, Sally was so very far away from that concept ever reaching fruition. The girls gathered around Sally to console her and lift her spirits and broke into song.
Folks never told you about.
You've been listening to an episode of The Wedding DJ, a story of love and music in the 1980s. The Wedding DJ is written, produced, and directed, and narrated by David Murray Adelstein.
You're ugly.
Thank you.